much. Thank you very much for the opportunity of presenting our work here. So I would like to talk about this work done in collaboration with Flaminia Giacomini and Czesław Bruckner in Vienna. And the work is about asking the question, what kind of limitations do we face if we want to measure time? And if we consider that the objects that we use to measure time are physical systems, like clocks that obey the laws of physics. So we want to consider in particular the gravitational and the quantum properties of these clocks and see what kind of limitations we find from trying to measure time with them. Part of the motivation for this work is this idea of locating an event in spacetime. This operational idea of having a grid of clocks and then locating an event by looking at the time measured by the clock when the event happened and the nearest clock to the event to signal out the event. We would like to see up to which extent can we do this when the clocks are not idealized objects, but rather physical things that interact with each other, and in particular gravitationally. So the first thing is I would like to kind of define what we mean by a clock, or at least give some necessary conditions for a system to behave like a clock. A necessary condition, the most important one, is that a clock cannot be in a stationary state of its Hamiltonian, because if it's in a stationary state of its Hamiltonian, it doesn't change. So we cannot use it to measure time. So a clock would necessarily be a system that is in a superposition of energy eigenstates of, say, this Hamiltonian. So the simplest possible model that we can find is this two-level system, this kind of qubit clock. And we will, for the first part of the talk, consider this as our clock. Of course, this is far from being a clock in all respects, but it will be sufficient for the conclusions we wanna draw in the first part. So how do we use this system as a clock? We prepare it in a state which is in a superposition between the ground state with energy E0 and the first excited state with energy E1, say this 0 plus 1 or the plus state in the quantum information jargon, and we let it evolve. And then we ask, are you in the state plus or are you in the state minus? If it's in the state plus, we conclude that 0 seconds or 0 units of time have passed. If we find it in the state minus, we conclude that 1 unit of time has passed. Of course, it could happen that 2 units of time pass and we still find it in the state plus. But this we can fix this problem by considering a system with more levels. But this is some kind of extra complication that will not be important for the moment. For the moment, what is important is to try to figure out how accurate or how precise this clock is. How precise is this clock? It has to do with how fast it undergoes a transition from the state 0 plus 1 to the state 0 minus 1, which is the state orthogonal to it that we can perfectly distinguish from the first one. And this has to do with the energy gap. So the time it goes, the time at which it undergoes the transition is called the orthogonalization time. And it turns out to be equal to pi h bar over delta E, where delta E is the energy gap, is E1 minus E0. So if we want a very precise clock, if we want a clock that perfectly distinguishes each point in the timeline, we would need to spend a lot of energy. This T orthogonal can also be thought of as some uncertainty in the clock. The bigger the T orthogonal is, the more uncertain our clock is, the more uncertain we are that our clock is telling us the right time. So this is a purely quantum mechanical consideration. This has only to do with quantum mechanics and Hamiltonian evolution of the clock. Now, what would happen if we consider also the gravitational properties of the clock? So in principle, this should be treated in a more kind of general relativistic setting. But for our purposes, it will just suffice that we consider the first contribution in 1 over c squared. This means to stay at the Newtonian level. So the gravitational properties of the clock will be important because the clock has an energy. And the clock has an energy, and therefore it generates, it sources a gravitational field. So if we think back about this idea of having a grid of clocks that are together and that we use to locate events, we would face a situation in which we have a clock and another clock nearby. And we would like to measure time very precisely here along the world line of, say, this clock and along the world line of this one. But then we can ask the question, how would this clock tick in the presence of this one? So if we have an energy E0, this clock will be time dilated with a gravitational potential, or it will have a time dilation that corresponds to a gravitational potential for this energy E0. Whereas if the energy is E1, the gravitational potential will be stronger and this clock will tick slower. But the point is, since this object here is a clock, is neither here nor here, rather in a superposition of E1 and E0. This means that this clock here does not know how to tick, right? So to speak, it has a superposition of time dilation. It has an uncertainty between ticking time dilated with respect to this energy or ticking time dilated with respect to this other energy. And so this is basically the main message of this work. Simply explained, this is the effect that we investigate through this model, and that becomes relevant because the more accurately one wants to measure time here, meaning we want to make this T orthogonal very small, the greater the uncertainty in time dilation in the clock nearby, meaning this delta T will be larger. So there seems to be a trade-off between the accuracy with which we can measure time here and with which we can measure time here. And this trade-off is kind of summarized or is kind of stated by this kind of uncertainty relation. This is the uncertainty of measuring time here that comes from a quantum mechanical consideration. And this is the uncertainty of in time dilation of this clock due to this clock. And if one multiplies the two of them together, since this one is inversely proportional to the energy gap and this one is directly proportional to the energy gap because it's proportional to the gravitational field that is proportional to the mass that is proportional to the energy gap, we see that this trade-off does not depend on delta E. This means it does not depend on... This delta E is the only thing, in some sense, that characterizes our clock. So no matter what clock we use, we will have this sort of trade-off. So this is the main point of the work, and then we can quantify this, or we can analyze this by building a model of clocks and let them interact gravitationally. So what we do is what I told you before was simply considering one clock as a quantum mechanical system in a superposition of energies, and the other clock, we just said, okay, this is a clock, and therefore it undergoes time dilation due to the superposition or due to the gravitational field stemming from this one. Now let's consider both clocks as quantum objects, and let's put them in this, say, initial state, both measuring time zero, and then let's let them interact through this Hamiltonian. So this Hamiltonian is, again, the gravitational interaction between the clocks to lowest order in 1 over c squared. One could, in principle, if one wants to incorporate general relativistic terms, one would include higher order terms in a, say, post-Newtonian expansion of the interaction. But I mean, it suffices to consider this type of interaction. And okay, something important here is who writes down this Hamiltonian. If we start from the kind of philosophy of defining time operationally, meaning time is what is measured by a clock, one should say this parameter T that appears here in the Schrödinger equation or in the evolution, what's the operational meaning of it? And I will come back to that a bit later, but for the moment, let's say we have these two clocks and there is some other observer very far away that has another clock, and this the time measured by this clock is precisely this T here, and it's so far away that it's not affected by the gravitational influence of these two clocks. So when we evolve in time, the state, and in time I mean when we evolve it with respect to this parameter defined by this other clock, we find that the state, which is initially separable, now gets entangled. So we have, if the clock say A, call this A and call this B, if the clock A is in zero in the ground state, then the clock B will tick normally with a phase that has no time dilation. Whereas if this clock is in one, the other clock will tick time dilated. So the whether the clock B ticks time dilated or not depends on the energy of clock A. Of course, this effect is symmetric. I just wanted to write it like this so that it becomes apparent, this correlation between ground state, no time dilation, excited state, time dilation. So the clocks get entangled, and because the clocks get entangled, when one wants to look at a single clock, say I have my two clocks here, and I want to measure time, but along this world line, not this one. So I will forget about the other clock. I will trace it out, and I will measure what time it is with respect to the clock that has interacted already with the other one. So all the measurements that I perform in this one will be, or all the probabilities will be given by the reduced density matrix of this clock. And because this clock got entangled with the other, this reduced density matrix will be in a mixed state. So let's say that the state, so this will be the state. Let's say that the interaction is such that this state is very mixed. This state is almost this one, like 1/2, 1, 0, 0, 1, almost some epsilon here. Whatever question we ask to that state, we will have a probability 1/2 of happening. So this means this object is not a good clock. Because if I ask the clock, what time is it, I have 1/2 probability of measuring 0 or 1/2 probability of measuring 1. So this is just in equations, or more in the language of clocks getting entangled, what I told you before, that one clock gets confused and does not know how to tick due to the presence of the other one. So this is the reduced state of one of the clocks is becomes a mixed state, and therefore is no longer able to act as a proper clock. So if we go back to this idea of having many clocks, like a grid of clocks, instead of just two, one can ask a similar question, but for one of the clocks being influenced by the rest of them. So one could start with a state that looks like this, an initial state of all clocks set at, say, 0 seconds, and then let them evolve with this Hamiltonian, which is just a generalization of the Hamiltonian before. And we can ask the question, how is the reading of this clock affected when it interacts with the neighboring ones? So what we see is that the reduced density matrix of this single clock looks pretty much like the reduced density matrix for the case where we had two clocks. It's just that it's powered to the n. The coherences are powered to the n. This means that the coherence will drop much faster. This is reasonable because it's interacting with many more systems. If one quantifies the visibility, which is basically the absolute value of this of these coherences, this is a measure of how mixed the state is. The visibility is very small, the state is very mixed, meaning that the system is no longer able to act as a clock. One can approximate this visibility by this quantity here, and one can ask, okay, how much time has to happen so that the visibility reaches 1 over e, its original value? And the answer is this time, which we call decoherence time, because it is the time when we lose the coherence in one of the clocks. So to put some numbers, not to propose an experiment or anything like that, because the numbers are pretty bad, it's just more in the spirit of comparing with usual works that approach the question of what are the fundamental limitations for defining time or space. We see that if we pack 10 to the 23 clocks in 10 to the minus 15 meters, and these clocks have an energy gap of 10 GeV, the clocks will not be able to work as clock after 80 seconds. So this is, of course, very bad if one wants to talk to an experimentalist and one wants to propose something to measure. But this is significant because this is still far away from the Planck scale, which is what in many works is stated as the ultimate limitation for defining what a point in time is. And the difference is, of course, that we're not looking at defining time or space at a single point, say, but we're looking at two clocks, and we're looking at how well we can define this grid. And we see that different elements of the grid interact with each other and decohere, and therefore we have these limitations. Okay, so this is kind of the first part.
Where did the 10 GeV come from? I mean, why was that a natural?
No, none of this is really natural. It's the natural question was, what kind of numbers could I put here so that I would see something that we could experience within our lifetimes or in a laboratory? Because if one puts something here that is much smaller, then one sees a very, very large time. 10 GeV is, I don't know, in particle physics experiments, are the energies associated to this. So there are systems with such energy.
But the other numbers look more like a crystal, no?
I'm sorry?
More like a crystal, what you're looking
at. A crystal?
Crystal. I wouldn't put 10 GeV. Seems to be a high end.
Right? Yeah, no, it's very high. Yes.
Putting it into 10, I mean, having 10 to the 23. That's 10 GeV.
It's a plasma.
Yeah, it's not very realistic. Of course, there will be many other effects that kick in before. Okay, so something I have to say is this is the time that would need to pass in order for see a drop of visibility of 1/E, which this is already maybe asking too much. Maybe we have a very precise way of measuring the visibility such that we don't need to wait for a drop of 1/E in the visibility, but rather a very tiny drop. So this would be maybe a more kind of reasonable way of testing the experiment. We would basically test the clock with a similar clock, as accurate as the one before. Okay. So this is kind of the first part of what I wanted to tell you. That if you put clocks together in a sort of array and you consider the gravitational interaction between them, the mere fact that they are clocks, meaning they're in a superposition of energies, leads to entanglement due to their gravitational interaction. And this entanglement means that after some time they are no longer able to function as proper clocks. So
at the beginning you talked about a trade-off. I'm curious, can you explain more about that? I mean, what's exactly the trade-off between?
Yes. So if we have two clocks, say we have clock one here and clock two here, and there's a difference, distance x between the two of them. And this clock is moving, this also. Say we nail them to the ground so that they don't... In some way, we prevent them from crashing at each other. And then say I want to measure time very precisely with this clock here. What this would mean is that I have to increase the energy gap of this clock. What this means is that the gravitational influence of this clock will be greater on this one. In particular, the uncertainty in time dilation of this clock will be greater. So it seems that the price we pay if we want to measure time very precisely here is that we will not be able to measure it very precisely here. So this is the trade-off. On the other hand, if we want to measure time very precisely here, we would have to decrease the energy. And if we decrease the energy here, this means the measurement of time here will not be as precise as we wanted it to be. So this is the. Does this?
Yeah, I mean, so can't you take that into account, just the time dilation?
Yes, I think something you could do in principle would be to put these two clocks in an entangled state, so that you could so that the time dilation does not lead to a decoherence of a single clock, and then measure time in kind of a tube form by the two clocks. This is another option, and this is an interesting question actually, because it seems then that the price we're paying is we are not able to define time along a single, say, line, but rather we're restricting ourselves to a tube. So there seems, if one follows this question, of course this tube will be interacting with other tubes. So there seems to be then also a trade-off between the width of this tube and the time by which we can be able to define define proper clocks this is an interesting, maybe for possible future work, to find a trade-off in those terms, in how well we can define time, like whether it's a world line or a world tube, or and how wide is this tube, and for how long we can do it. Okay, so the second part, what I would like to talk about is, if we have this effect, if we have this problem for finding good clocks or for the measurability of time, how is it that we don't see it? How is it that in the classical limit this effect is somehow washed out? So I would like to explain this part now, and in order to explain this part, I have to consider a bit more complicated clocks. The clocks that I will consider will be now coherent states, meaning if we have a qubit, say we power it to a very, very high number, and this would be a coherent state. One can picture it as a very large spin pointing in some direction. This is, and we call this coherent state the state theta phi j. And this will be our clock now. This will be some pointer that is moving around, and that by finding the location of the pointer, we can find what time it is. So one of the features that comes out, or one of the things that will play an important role for finding this classical limit, will be the notion of a coarse measurement. So every time, if we have our pointer and the pointer is moving around, we will not be able to, like realistically, we will not be able to know the exact point where the pointer is pointing, but we will be able to just know if the pointer is within a finite region of this. And this finite region characterizes, or the size of this region characterizes the coarseness of the measurement. So let's say we start with the same state so now I'm talking about a free clock with no gravitational interaction between this clock and other clocks. I will explain how this classical or semi-classical clock works, and then I will put this semi-classical clock to interact with other clocks and see how we reach the classical limit. So this clock would be running with this Hamiltonian, which is just a generalization. So this clock is a n-level system, or 2j-level system, with equal spacings in the energies. It will, if we put it in the plus state, say pointing towards the x-axis of the Bloch sphere, it will, and let it evolve under this Hamiltonian, it will start to rotate along the equator of the Bloch sphere. And we will measure time by finding the position of this pointer in this Bloch sphere. We do this by this POVM, which is just slicing the Bloch sphere as if it were an orange with a certain width, that we call it R. And then the probability of measuring k seconds will just be the trace of the density matrix of the clock times the kth POVM element. And this will be a function of the Husimi function of the clock, or could be expressed as a function of the Husimi function of the clock. So when is our clock not classical? Well, when there is a non-negligible probability of finding the clock in more than one bin. So if this number j is small with respect to the coarseness of this measurement here, we will have a picture that looks like this, meaning I have a non-negligible probability of finding the clock here and here and here. There will be quantum effects due to this. On the other hand, if this j is very large, we would have a picture like this, in which this thing will be rotating along this block sphere, and the probability of finding it in more than one bin will be non-negligible. Negligible. Even more, if one finds it here, the state will be practically undisturbed, and one could use it again and measure it again, and so on. So this is what we mean by a clock in the classical limit. Now let's take two of them and let them interact gravitationally through exactly the same Hamiltonian that we used for the qubit case. So this is a, say, 2J level system with equal spacing. So say the mean energy of this clock will be delta E times J. And we want to see what happens to the reduced density matrix of this other clock when it interacts with this guy. And we consider both of them in an initial state that looks like this, say the plus state for both of them. And we're going to let them interact. It turns out, after one does the calculation, that the reduced density matrix of the clock P looks like this. So it's just a incoherent sum of different Husimi functions. And these different Husimi functions will rotate again along the block sphere, but they will rotate at different speeds. The ones that correspond to a higher energy will rotate slower, so they will stay behind because they will be more time dilated. The ones with corresponding to a low energy will rotate faster, and the one corresponding to the average energy will tick time dilated according to the average energy of the other clock. So this would be what would happen maybe in semi-classical gravity, where we want to find out the gravitational effects due to a quantum object. We would just take the average of the stress energy tensor of this object and then put that into the Einstein equations and see what happens to whatever other particles influenced by this. So we will see that. So the effect that we have here are two. One is the movement of the clock as a whole with respect to the, say, average phase. And the other is that these Husimi functions tend to separate from each other. And the question whether we will have a classical limit or not will have to do with which of these two effects is stronger. The quantum part has to do with this Husimi function separating from each other. Because then this would lead to us finding the clock in more than one bin. So there will be quantum fluctuations. On the other hand, if this spreading is negligible with respect to the movement of the clock as a whole, we will be able to find a bin such that all of the, or at least the most significant terms in this sum fit in. So in order to find which of these two effects is more significant, we look at how the average phase, the phase that moves time dilated with respect to the mean energy of the other clock, depends on J. It turns out that it depends linearly on J, like this. And if one takes J to be very large, one can approximate this distribution, this binomial distribution, by a Gaussian distribution. And the width of this Gaussian distribution will be given by the square root of J instead of just J. This means that the effective phase difference, the spreading of the Husimi functions, how fast they separate from each other, will depend on the square root of J instead of J. So it turns out that in the classical limit, meaning in the limit where J is very large, the movement of the clock as a whole will dominate over the spreading of the clock. And this is how we would reach classical limits from the clocks. So I don't know, any questions so far? No. Okay, so, well, I think I still have time to tell you a bit more about So this is still work in progress, what I'm going to tell you about, but it has to do with something that it's a bit uncomfortable about analyzing the clocks in this way, which is the fact that we have somehow a preferred clock, which is the clock that we used as our parameter t in order to evolve this the system. So we would like to see, so this is the picture more or less. We see the two clocks, but then we consider a clock that is very, very far away, and we see the time evolution with respect to this clock, and we define the time evolution with respect to this clock. And this more or less gives us an operational meaning of what this t in the Schrödinger equation is, but it's not very satisfactory because we're not treating, say, all the clocks in the on the same footing. So something we would like to do, or some interesting idea in order to treat the clocks on the same footing, has to do with a Page and Wouters mechanism, or a Page and Wouters approach, in which one starts with a quantum state that is in an eigenstate of a Hamiltonian. So it's not moving, it's not evolving in time, and one recovers time from the quantum correlations of the one recovers time internally from the correlations between the objects that that conforms the system. So we would like to see if one can get something like that by starting from a Hamiltonian with interacting systems, that would be the gravitational interaction between them, and then one could get the Hamiltonian that we had before, describing the time dilation of the clocks. So I don't know, are you familiar with this Page and Wouters, how it works more or less? Or I mean, it's just the simplest case would be, say we have a Hamiltonian that looks like this. Would be the Hamiltonian of a clock and the Hamiltonian of the rest of the system. And say we require that the Hamiltonian acting on the state kills the state. So for simplicity, let's say this has a canonically conjugate operator such that this happens. This is just for simplicity. So I'm jumping from qubits to n-level systems to continuous systems, but this is just for simplicity. It can be so let's say something like this happens. And then let's start from this equation and let's condition this equation on the clock measuring time t. If one does this and one looks at this, one would see that t acting on hc, acting on psi, would be nothing but minus I times d in dt acting on, say, t psi, right? Because this is just, say, hc is like the momentum operator. So it acts like a derivative. So if we would have this, and we do this operation here, what one would get is, in the end, this would mean minus I d in dt psi of t plus hs psi of t equals zero, right? And this is just the Schrödinger equation.
But here you're just rewriting the system.
I'm sorry?
You're just rewriting the same system? So you still have the outside clock, which is c.
So what we want to do is precisely to have an outside clock, to get rid of the outside clock. So we would, yes.
But right now you write.
Yeah. Now it's just an introduction to how this, yes. Yes, exactly.
In general, it said that H. and Wouters, this interpretation actually has its problems.
Yes. When
point a system which you can easily rewrite.
When you want to measure
consecutive. It's not consistent in itself.
Yes, yes.
But there is a consistent formalism to deal with constrained systems.
Okay.
Which is just Dirac quantization.
Yes, yes.
And then there's a formalism. Just to say that one doesn't need to really employ agent models.
Okay.
But I guess now you want to get rid of HC.
I want to get rid of HC, and I want to start from some sort of Hamiltonian that is in some sense symmetrical.
Yeah.
So all of them interacting. So the difference between this and what I want to consider is that what I want to consider has an interaction between the clocks, whereas here it's the clocks are not interacting.
Then HC is basically a very simple thing because it's just actually the momentum conjugated to t.
Yes.
So that's
yes.
what we call parameterized, and that's basically that.
Yes.
These are equivalent to the usual Schrödinger equation.
Yes, yes. This will be equivalent to the Schrödinger equation, but now we would like to couple it to other clocks.
I guess, okay, I will see, but Page and Buta basically allows you still to work with these kinematical observables, whereas in the other case, you need to really have these Dirac observables, and they are harder to construct.
Okay, we can talk about this later. But what we have at the moment is a way of, say, starting from a Hamiltonian in which the clocks interact with each other that looks like this, which is not what I wrote there, because what I wrote there is just three terms, and obtain an equation that looks pretty much like the equation we had before when for the time dilation between the clocks. Then afterwards, so the maybe most problematic part is to see what happens when one wants to incorporate maybe measurements of the clocks or something like that. Because then, as far as I know, that's the problematic part with this Page Wouters formalism, that if you want to do consecutive measurements, you would violate what you stated before, saying that the clock is in an eigenstate, in a zero eigenstate, because you would project it, and then you will...
you're not working on what we call physical Hilbert.
You will get out of the constraint. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
No, that's, you get out of the constraint, because you work with things which are not observables.
Okay.
So, but in principle, you could write a system which would be interesting, where in the beginning you had, for instance, two clocks, so you consider a Hamiltonian, which is just the sum of these two Hamiltonians, and deal, would treat it as a constraint. But then the kind of question you can ask is not what is the time at a given clock, but what is the time of a given clock if the other clock shows a certain value.
Yes.
And that turns out, then it would be interesting to see whether basically, that there are also some restrictions on the kind of measurements you can get.
Yes.
Which comes through this relational formalism. And it would be really interesting to see how it relates to the restriction
to this
you got, which is actually
okay
different because it comes from a gravitational interaction. Whereas in the other case, you can add gravitational interaction or not.
Okay.
But in principle, it's already that through this relational construction, you do get already restrictions on this kind of observables or questions.
Without putting any interaction.
Putting interaction, because you can only ask, what is one clock showing?
Yes.
If the other clock shows some value.
Okay.
Obviously, we have asked the same question. But it was with respect to the far away outside clock.
Yes, I think. I think it's similar to what we are doing at the moment because the way this works, say for three clocks, is one would write something like this. Say HA plus HB plus HC plus interaction terms. something like this. And this would be like the Hamiltonian of the whole system. And then one would ask that this acting on the physical state is zero. And then we see this as some sort of reference frame kind of thing. If we have this, we can ask what would happen if I jump into the clock, say C, for example. So this would mean that I would contract this equation with a clock of C. And I would like to see what kind of Schrödinger equation I see when I jump into C's clock somehow, or into C's frame. I don't know if this is more or less.
I do understand. I don't really roughly understand how we get to the last line without assuming that HC is very simple.
I'm sorry?
Well, basically,
I do understand what you want to do, because that's a standard thing to do. I don't understand how you get the last line, which out assuming that HC is basically extremely simple, which is just PT, and it would give you back the usual story.
Ah, yes.
The far away clock.
Yes. Oh, okay. So HC would be PT in a we could consider a limit in which HC could be like a n level system, and we could consider the limit where n goes. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes. The.
It's the same. Is that roughly the same?
I don't know if the limit has to do, the fact that you get an equation like this has to do with an approximation we do in this parameter.
I see.
Yes.
But not. Yeah, could you, because I think that's a very interesting point that you're making, that the Hamiltonian constraint in quantum gravity parlance that you're using is not of the form HC plus something else, but it has also this interaction.
Yes. So the way it works basically is like this.
But here it's even stronger. It's assumed that HC is just PT. It's linear in the momentum.
Or is there some limit that makes it linear?
I'm sorry?
Kind of decoupling of HC or system C from the rest.
I don't think so. This is very symmetric. So if one does this, and one does this, one would substitute by derivative with respect to t every time one finds hc, right?
See what you have written on the blackboard, but I don't know.
Ah, oof.
But that's what you have written there in the last line. I mean, you have written that if t is a time of c.
Yes.
The right hand side does not know anything about c.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So
yes.
Somehow assume that it decoupled from.
Well, T was originally coupled to A and B. But by standing on C, is kind of I stand in the reference frame of C, and then I would, from the point of view of somebody far away, one would say, okay, C is entangled with A and B, because they're interacting gravitationally. But now I want to say I jump into the reference frame of C, and this entanglement goes. I think we're saying the same.
I think I understand, just that if you want to arrive at this form, I think you make very strong assumptions about C.
Okay.
And that's basically the kind of interaction between anything and C is basically zero. So otherwise,
Well, I mean, this is a very simple, yes, a very simple kind of model.
For us, typically, it's more interesting to not to make this assumption, because in gravity, we do not have such a system which would allow us to do that.
Okay. Okay, let's say from this perspective, even if it's weakly interacting, we get some gravitational effects. Like we get this equation in which C sees that A and B are time dilated with respect to each other.
Okay. But you can see effects between each.
Yes, exactly. So I don't know, maybe to finish, the way this works is, well, shall I do it or? Well, it's just basically, whenever you see C, and then here. So we get to an equation that looks like this. I 1 plus lambda AC HA plus lambda BC HB times psi of T. I'm going to call this T now TC to emphasize that we're in the frame of C or with respect to the clock C. Sorry, this is d in dt. And this would just be equal to h a plus h b plus lambda a b h. Right. Now, so this is almost the equation there. It's just we have to take this to this side. And if it's a bit cumbersome, but if one takes this to this side and one approximates, one says lambda AC and lambda BC is small, one gets there.
So that's basically the decoupling
type. Okay.
That you need that.
Yes, yes, you put the inverse.
So it's not a minus, but an inverse, okay.
Yeah.
But that's why he needs lambda AC.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, yes, okay.
So it's.
If lambda is small, you get that equation. Otherwise, you would just put the inverse, and this would be. Yeah, some other Hamiltonian, see. And so, yeah.
This operator at the left hand side is like the quantization of the redshift.
Of the, yes, this is an operator, right? This is some sort of. Yes, it will depend on the energy of the different clocks. So the redshift will be in a superposition, so to say, something like that. Well, and then, yeah, I don't know. Are there any other questions, comments?
I think it would be interesting to do the speak of clock example.
Mm-hmm.
This is constraint system. Yeah. However, as before, they are very simple systems, but all very similar, like three-level systems.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
Finite-dimensional Hilbert space. It might not be too hard to compute things.
Yes.
Just that the notion of time will be very particular, and since it's a three-level system. Can only measure so many time values. But that would be really more, I mean, the very symmetric situation. We have not really in gravity, but in some sense, it's more similar to gravity.
Yes.
So here, the strongest assumption you make, which is I see this difference, and indeed the tilde is basically the redshift.
Yes, exactly.
Typically, the strongest assumption you make is replacing ht with dt.
Uh-huh.
And that means that we have one good time in your system, and the time runs always forward, and that in your entire constraint system, there's a momentum which is linear, where the Hamiltonian is linear in the momentum.
Yes, yes, yes.
In relativistic systems, all these things, we have only systems which are quadratic in the momentum.
Okay.
And then the problem is if they're quadratic, time can run backwards and forwards.
Because of the p squared, or yeah.
It's always p squared. And if you have this system, this effect that it can run backward and forward, you basically get additional effects on the existence of good clocks and also quantum effects just from this fact.
Okay.
And the mathematical necessity to really construct observers or observables which would not leave the space of solutions, and already there you basically find restrictions. But I guess if you really have like these, well, one could consider it's really these discrete n-level systems.
Yes.
And not make this assumption and try to construct really.
So this PT that you mentioned, I think it's the continuum limit of considering clocks that look like this.
It would be interesting to see whether having only two levels.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that is a periodic system.
Yes.
So I wouldn't see necessarily that you can describe it in a linear momentum. So I guess if you do the limit to infinity, it means maybe you can only go forward and you never go backwards because it goes to infinity.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a two-level system, maybe a really harmonic oscillator,
you will probably go backwards, yes.
Probably there's something quadratic or it's a cosine with some frequency. So,
yeah.
I guess, and then we'll have these effects. And I guess you could consider some limits where you have an n-level system and consider n maybe big but not infinity.
Yes.
To see something.
Yes.
So for the two-level system, DODT is just DODT phi, where phi is periodic.
Yes, yes. Or for an n-level system, it would be like that. Yes. Yes. It's a bit more complicated to do the calculation because you have this periodicity problem. This is some sort of way of simplifying it. But I guess the way to understand this would be better in terms of like a limit of these n-level systems, which is I think the notion of a clock that we introduced from the beginning, like this discrete system which has many levels.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that is discrete, but it's really the problem that in GR we don't have a clock which would always go forward.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So maybe one can construct something which goes up to the highest level and then it has to go backwards.
Yeah. No, this is yes. Maybe not a clock that works forever, but
yeah.
But for.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah.
Yes. I agree. Yeah. So I don't know. This is. I think this is pretty much what I wanted to say. I don't know. I would like to then conclude the talk by I don't know, summarizing what we talked about is there is this effect in which time at nearby points is not arbitrarily well defined due to the gravitational interaction between the clocks and we presented this with a model of some discrete clocks, but I think the same is true if one chooses whatever other clock to it's just a matter of a clock has to be in a superposition of energies. Superposition of energies means superposition of gravitational influences, and superposition of gravitational influences means the clocks get entangled, and this effect happens. So this effect is not in terms of creating black holes or something like which are effects that are usually mentioned as the limitations for defining what we mean by space or what we mean by time. It's rather effects that have to do with time at a certain region. We saw how to get the classical limits out of this via the notion of a coarse measurement, and we discussed a little bit this how to get rid of the outside clock somehow to make it more a bit more symmetric. And well, Thank you very much.
Gone back to the Einstein-Bohr debate about the photon box.
Mm-hmm.
Considered what, what you said in the early part of the talk reminded me of that, which is this was Einstein's attempt to overcome the energy-time uncertainty relation, and he imagined photon box. You open an aperture, and you open and close it, and you time how long it was open for. That's your delta T.
Yes.
But you're weighing the whole box, so you know what its initial mass was and what its final mass was. So you also know how much energy was emitted by taking the difference. And so Einstein's argument was you can measure that delta E as precisely as you like. So the product of delta E and delta T doesn't satisfy any bound. And then Bohr finally responded to it by saying that there's uncertainty about when the photon actually leaves the box. So you don't know how much time it spends, let's say it's like suspended by a spring. You don't know how much time it spends high in the gravitational field or low in the gravitational field. And then because of time dilation, that introduces uncertainty in the running of the clock, which is introduces uncertainty in the delta T. And so you can prove that delta E and delta T are related.
Okay.
It's interesting because it's like you appeal to time dilation to salvage the energy-time uncertainty.
Uncertainty principle, yes.
It seems like you couldn't salvage it unless you appeal to time dilation.
Yes.
So you're also appealing to the effects of this superposition of energy levels on the time dilation of the system. So there's an uncertainty in the time dilation, which is exactly what's happening in the photon box experiment.
Yes, yes.
So I don't really have a question except, have you noticed this, and does...
I guess the main difference between these two things is that in one is considering the gravitational field of the Earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the gravitational field is... So here we're considering the object that produces the gravitational influence to be in a quantum superposition of things. So we really have a situation where there is not a fixed, say, metric, or there is not a fixed gravitational field. I guess that's the main difference. And part of what we're trying to do with this approach of say jumping into one of the clocks is say, despite the fact that I'm entangled and that I would not be able to define time from an outside point of view, when I jump into it, I see that I somehow decouple from the rest of the clock, so I can write an approximate Schrödinger equation for the rest of the systems somehow.
Maybe just one follow-up, that maybe it would be interesting to try to explore whether the following is true, that the only way you can get back kind of quantum theory when you move to these relations is if you take on board the equivalence principle or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So this
mm-hmm.
could be false, but I look at Bohr's response to the Einstein photon box.
Yes.
On the face of it, it looks like it's telling you that quantum theory is only consistent, or, you know, like
if we take into account fully the...
If you take into account the equivalence
principle. Yes.
And so I just wonder if there would be another way of trying to show that same moral by showing that if you didn't take it on board the equivalence principle, then you know you could start with quantum theory one place and then end up with something.
And then you could end up with, yes, and this is interesting, yes.